oppression and occupation of Palestinians. But nevertheless, despite his attempts to crush the hopes of his rivals in wrestling the premiership from him, after the ceasefire between Hamas and the Israelis, brokered by Egypt on May 21st, talks between Netanyahu's rivals of forming a coalition government to get rid of him resumed in the wake of the bloodbath that had left so many killed and injured in Palestine. On May 30th, 2021, Naftali Bennett announced that he would be joining with Yair Lapid in the aim of forming a so-called unity government. This would include a coalition of 8 different parties from all across the political spectrum. On June 2nd, minutes before the deadline, a coalition government was forged, which would see the role of Prime Minister shared, with Bennett taking the reins for 2 years, and then Lapid. On June 13th, 2021, Naftali Bennett was sworn in as Prime Minister, and during his speech in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, several Netanyahu loyalists attempted to interrupt him, accusing him of treachery as they were being removed from the chamber. Netanyahu himself gave a fiery speech accusing his rivals of election fraud, and much like former US President Trump, refused to accept the results, calling it the greatest election fraud in history, perhaps even in the history of democracy. When entering the Knesset, he sat in the Prime Minister's chair before being told to relocate to a different seat. And in the final moments of his ouster, Netanyahu implied that the new government was doing the bidding of Tehran, of Hamas and Hezbollah, by gifting them with his removal from power. And then he gave a final warning just before he left, saying, quote, "We'll be back." Indeed, he intends to remain the leader of his Likud party and to lead the opposition, with many speculating that Netanyahu will be back and that he'll try to run again and wrestle control of the premiership back into his grasp. Now, what makes the coalition put together interesting is not just the fact that it's comprised of 8 parties on seemingly opposing ends of the political spectrum, but also includes for the first time some Israeli Arab politicians as part of the United Arab List. Now, 8 parties, all united by their common hatred for Netanyahu, managed to get rid of him. But what of his replacement? What of Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli Prime Minister, and the head of the far-right party, New Right, which is also under the umbrella of the Yamina movement, an ultra-nationalist movement? Naftali Bennett originally started outside of politics. He made his fortunes as a tech millionaire, having lived for a while in the United States. His parents are originally American Jews who moved from the United States to occupied Palestine. Like most Israeli settlers, either they themselves, their parents, or their grandparents all come from outside of Palestine. They are not indigenous to Palestine. Just ask any Palestinian where their grandparents were born, and I can assure you, most of them will not tell you the USA or Germany or Ukraine or wherever else. Now, before politics, Bennett was also part of the Israeli occupation forces and took part in numerous attacks on Lebanon, including the Qana massacre in 1996, when the Israelis shelled a United Nations compound, killing 106 Lebanese civilians. Originally, Bennett entered politics under a right-wing party and then went on to join Yamina, which identifies as ultra-nationalist. Once again, it's a bit difficult to understand what they mean here, since every political party there by default validates the Israeli occupation and upholds its existence, which by its very nature oppresses Palestinians in favor of a Jewish nation state. Now, Bennett has always publicly opposed a Palestinian state and always supported the expansion of illegal settlements. At one point, he was the head of the Yesa Council, a large settler organization. Needless to say, these settlers live in Palestine illegally. There are multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions stating very clearly that these settlements are unlawful and stand in violation of international law. When it comes to his animosity and hatred towards Palestinians, there's no shortage of comments there. Perhaps to further illustrate how much of a wonderful person Bennett is, let's look at a few of his quotes, shall we? Bennett once said in 2018 that he would, quote, "not give another centimeter to the Arabs." In 2013, during an interview with The Guardian, he said, "there is not going to be a Palestinian state within the tiny land of Israel." He previously also expressed his disdain for international law, claiming somehow that Israel's numerous illegal annexations, declared null and void by the United Nations, are not illegal, according to him. In 2012, he was quoted in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz as saying, quote, "I will do everything in my power forever to fight against a Palestinian state." He's also called Palestinian children terrorists and said, quote, "I've killed lots of Arabs in my life, and there's no problem with that." And of course, this is the man that Western leaders like US President Joe Biden and others immediately call and congratulate and grovel to. You see, racism and terrorism are fine with them as long as it's happening to Arabs and Muslims. Equally, Bennett's cabinet members have no shortage of colorful comments either. Yair Lapid, who will take over after 2 years as the alternate prime minister, said that he is, quote, enthusiastically in favor of annexing the Syrian Golan Heights. My principle says maximum Jews on maximum land with maximum security with minimum Palestinians. The new finance minister, Lieberman, said once in 2006 that, quote, any Arab members of the Knesset who meet with representatives of the PA's Hamas-led government should be executed. And previously, when he was transport minister on Palestinian prisoners, he said that, quote, it would be better to drown these prisoners in the Dead Sea if possible, since that's the lowest point in the world. Benny Gantz, who was supposed to share the premiership with Netanyahu under a coalition agreement, has now been reappointed defense minister and new deputy prime minister. Just one day after assuming the role of prime minister, Bennett proceeded to bomb Gaza on the night of June 15th to June 16th, and then again a second time during the same week on June 17th. In the Israeli and Western corporate media, the story was reported as the Israelis launching airstrikes in response to incendiary balloons launched by Hamas, which of course sounds very proportionate and civilized. Naturally, the media left out the part that this was a response to the flag march in Al-Quds, in the holy city of Jerusalem. One of the first actions taken by Bennett's administration was to approve a right-wing march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was captured in the 1967 war and consequently annexed. It has been under illegal Israeli occupation ever since. These are the same mobs that have been carrying out pogroms for the last few months that just marched through Jerusalem, looting and damaging Palestinian-owned businesses. They have been filmed laughing and joking at the death of Palestinians, calling for a second Nakba and for the ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinian population. All of this, of course, with the protection of Israeli police who stand there and cuddle them and do nothing. And not only that, but they participate with them in oppressing the Palestinians. One woman who held a Palestinian flag was filmed being beaten to the ground by Israeli police. Under Bennett, Palestinians were also offered 1 million vaccines by the Israelis, with one caveat: they're expired. And so not only does the medical apartheid continue, but all of the apartheid continues, all of the cruelty, the entire cruelty of the occupation in all its dimensions continues. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
Joining me is Dr. Bassem Naim. He is the former Palestinian health minister and now the head of the International Relations Office of Hamas in Gaza. Thank you for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you on, Doctor.
Please, an honor to be with you today.
So, Doctor, I wanted to ask you, first of all, this new prime minister of the Israeli occupation, Naftali Bennett, he's made remarks in the past that he is proud to have killed Arabs. He is completely against any Palestinian state. I wanted to ask you, this change of leadership, does it mean anything for Palestinians? What does it actually represent on the ground in reality?
Look, for us Palestinians here, it doesn't make any difference between these different Israeli governments, right or left. And if it is a negative change, look, when it comes to the Palestinian issue, we believe, and this is the practical thing we see on the ground, there is no differences between right and left. All what they are discussing is only internal issues. Internal Israeli issues, but when it comes to the Palestinian conflict, when it comes to the borders, the settlements, to Jerusalem, to refugees, right to return, the right to attack Palestinians, to suffocate them, since 1948, we have a steady, constant policy from all governments. And if there is a change in, when it comes to this new government, maybe it is a negative one. I mean, more aggression, more violence against the Palestinian existence here on the land. But if there is a question, we have the right to raise it as Palestinians there today, that why the international community, in particular the West, Europe, and America, usually exercising a lot of pressures on Palestinians to go on the path of what so-called peace and stability and prosperity, and they are asking us to review our curricula in the schools, they are asking us to review our media, and so on and so on. But when it comes to what so-called the prime minister, who is proud of killing Palestinians or Arabs in general, and he is ready to repeat it again and again, when we have a minister of interior, the so-called Eilat Shaqid, when she is publicly stated that she is calling for killing all Palestinian mothers because they are going to give birth for a new terrorist, I hope that the international community can leave the position of not only double standard, double or triple standards, and to hear clear, not only clear statements, but also actions towards the such terrorist government.
How does it make you feel to see Arabs, Palestinians in this coalition government? What kind of message does that send? How does that make you feel?
The Palestinians generally are divided here in two parties. One party see that this is their right to decide how to deal with the status quo without recognizing the occupation as a state. And the other part, which is forbidding totally any engagement, especially at the official level with the Israeli occupation. We here in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, I mean the occupied territories in 1967, we leave this for them to decide how to deal with this with their situation inside the occupied territories in 1948. But on the bottom line, the baseline is not to recognize this occupation or to legitimize it.
So, you know, Doctor, I wanted to ask of you, we saw these Israeli marches through Al-Quds, through Jerusalem, where these mobs are chanting death to Arabs, you know, they're laughing and joking, they're calling for a second Nakba, for more ethnic cleansing. And at the same time, as you saw, unfortunately, they started bombing Gaza again. They broke the ceasefire on May 21st. You know, they attacked public health infrastructure. Many clinics and hospitals were damaged. At Shifa Hospital, which I'm sure you know very well, they bombed the road leading there. And I mean, it's not the first time, is it? But, you know, what do you have to say about this massacring of Palestinians that is still ongoing, the damage to infrastructure, the medical apartheid in the broader context of the occupation of Palestine?
Look, when we hear this group of extremists chanting openly and publicly death to Arabs and death to Muslims, or calling for destroying Al-Aqsa Mosque, or on so on, it, and protected by the Israeli police and covered by all Israeli media, calling or considering them as heroes, this is reflecting that this is the official policy of the state of Israel. This is not a group of gangs at the periphery of the mainstream of the state. It is in the heart of this group of young people are representing Naftali Bennett and Eilat Shaqid and other official figures in the state of Israel. When it comes to the massacring of Palestinians, again, this is the adopted policy since 1948. Look, if you go through the diary, in each day you will find the memory or the anniversary, sorry, of one or two or three, or sometimes in one day five or six massacres committed by the Israel, by the Zionist entity or their groups since 1948 until today, either here in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, in Tunis, and everywhere. Therefore, again and again, this is the adopted official policy of this Zionist entity, how to eliminate the Palestinian existence on this land and around it. When it comes to attacking health facilities or killing children, usually they are using some allegations that they are targeting security offices or offices affiliated to the resistance. First of all, they were not able to show one proof of their allegations until today. Second, we know if they want to target someone specifically, they can do it. You know that they have the most sophisticated weapons, the most precise weapons supported by the Americans. Why to destroy a house or a building with 13 or 14 floor because of the allegations they have one or two offices in this high buildings working for the resistance.
And Doctor, just as a final question, you've been very gracious with your time. I just want to ask you, what can people who are listening, the viewers, what can they do to help the Palestinian cause? And you know, very often we never get to hear directly from Palestinians in the English-speaking world. Everything about Hamas is filtered through the Zionist narrative, through the Western narrative. So I want to give you the floor, and I want to ask you, what would you like to say directly to the viewers, to the audience?
Thank you very much. This is a very important question. And I will start from the point you have raised, because this is the most important point. The Israeli or the Zionist entity is depending on two pillars. The first one, their own capacity or capabilities here, security and air forces and army, and the other one, the international support, because they are presenting themselves as representative of the Western values, of the Western cultures, as a civilized state, as a state which is defending human rights and equity, and so on and so on. This image, I think anyone will be very helpful for the Palestinians if they convey the reality on the ground here, that this is a fascist colonial project violating all kinds of human rights, all kinds of good values, of the values of more or most civilized people, equity and justice and freedom of expression, freedom of journalism. We have seen it live in real time, how they are killing children, how they are attacking women, how they are squashing men and women on crossings in the West Bank or in Jerusalem. Therefore, to help Palestinians to convey their message or to convey the Palestinian narrative to pass through this filter is a very great help for us. The second thing is we Palestinians, we are not war, what we call it in English, we are not war makers or war lovers. We are really looking to live in peace. We are really looking to live that our children have the chance of a better life, a dignified life, to live like any children around the world. And we have given all the chances to the Zionist entity and to the international community to solve this political conflict in a peaceful way or a political way, avoiding further bloodshed and killing of people, of children, women. But they have always denied our basic rights of a statehood, of dignity, of freedom. Therefore, we have resorted to armed resistance, which is guaranteed right in the international law, by the way. It is our full right to resist the occupation. We are the oppressed people, and the Israelis are the oppressor, and we have the right to resist it. But we have resorted to this track or to this tool because we have seen after 7 decades that no one is really caring about our life, about our future.
Let us not forget that during his tenure, Netanyahu oversaw the assassinations of several Iranian nuclear scientists. He openly and vehemently rejected the Iran nuclear deal and any diplomatic endeavors. He approved several acts of sabotage and nuclear terrorism against Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and then had the nerve to go to the United Nations General Assembly and accuse Iran of developing a nuclear weapon when Israel is the only party who has nuclear weapons. Netanyahu oversaw the brutal assaults on Gaza in 2014 and again in 2021, with thousands of Palestinians being ruthlessly murdered and wounded. In 2016, he secured the largest package of military aid from the United States in history, totaling $38 billion over a period of 10 years to subsidize these atrocities. He launched hundreds of airstrikes on Syria, if not thousands, taking advantage of the chaotic situation in Syria to attack her while she was weak. Under his rule, the Israelis openly worked to assist and give aid to Al-Qaeda fighters inside Syria just for the sake of helping to topple the Syrian government. Netanyahu tried to move forward with his annexation plan on July 1st, 2020, but ultimately didn't. His plans to annex a further 30% of the West Bank, they didn't come to fruition, but he still tried, and he still got something else in return. Normalization of ties with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates in the form of the Abraham Accords, orchestrated by a grinning Trump, who also moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to occupy Jerusalem and recognized the illegally occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli. So how different is Bennett if he supports all these and more? On the eve of Bennett taking power, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry issued a statement clearly saying that this is not real change because there is no change in the attitude towards Palestinians. That, quote, as for the new government's policies, we estimate we will see no difference or perhaps even worse ones. Similar statements were echoed by Hamas and Palestinians alike everywhere. And indeed, let us be under no illusions. Whether Netanyahu has stayed or is replaced by Bennett makes little difference. Perhaps Bennett is more direct in his approach and his rhetoric and speaks with more animosity. But his actions are just as bad as Netanyahu's, if not perhaps slightly worse. Just like his predecessor, he is in favor of annexation. He supports expanding the illegal settlements. He is in favor of brutal military assaults bombing Gaza, allowing Zionists to march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem, unchecked, chanting death to Arabs. Bennett is in favor of ethnic cleansing, of genocide, of oppressing Palestinians, and making sure they never attain statehood, nor be given their basic human rights. Bennett, just like Netanyahu, is the leader of an occupation. It's that simple. And unfortunately, this means that nothing changes on the ground. This means that Palestinians continue to live under a racist, apartheid entity, under colonialism that is supported and subsidized by the West. Indeed, nothing has changed, save for a few faces and a few names. The cruelty of oppression, of occupation, of colonialism and apartheid continues in all its dimensions. This has not changed and not stopped. And therefore, neither should the resistance to colonialism and imperialism. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا مصيبة كعدم العقل.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, there is no affliction worse than a lack of intellect.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find, dear friends, in the beautiful conversations of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the divinely appointed Imam, we find that he talks about certain things with his companions, which when we delve a little deeper, we find that they are beautiful pearls of wisdom and knowledge. And these pearls of wisdom and knowledge truly can help us and our societies and our world to become a better place. In one of these instances, when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is having a conversation with his companions, we find that in response to a question from his companion, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Be careful of your friends, except the trusty one who fears Allah." It's very interesting, dear friends, but in this day and age of social media and even non-social media, for example, school and workplace and these kind of social areas, we make a lot of friends, we make a lot of acquaintances, we get to know a lot of people. But dear friends, keep in mind that not every single person is trustworthy. Yes, your parents are trustworthy. Yes, I mean, that's pretty much it. Your parents are the most trustworthy person that you can rely on. Of course, this does not mean that you should have a negative view about your friends, but always be careful. Here, Imam al-Baqir says, yes, the one who is trustworthy and the one who fears Allah, this is truly a good friend. And of course, this makes sense if you have an acquaintance or you have a friend who does not fear Allah, then they are bound to take you towards a path which could very well lead away from Allah. But the friend who is trustworthy and who fears Allah will always keep you on a path which goes towards Allah. For not only will they fear disobeying Allah, but they will help you to fear disobeying Allah as well. Beautiful words of wisdom. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One or two, you know, incidents from his life about his akhlaq, just to learn the seerah of the Imam, is the issue of, you know, sabr, patience in dealing with the people who are rude to you. And we see this example in the life of the Prophet, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the example of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zainul Abideen. But since we are remembering the fifth Imam, let us look at his example, where somebody, and it seems, you know, people had been brainwashed against the Ahlul Bayt. And this individual was from Ahlul Kitab, either a Christian or a Jew, we don't know. And he was an Arab. We're talking about Ahlul Kitab from the Arab community. Knowing the Imam and his name and his laqab, his name was Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam, but Baqir was the laqab, the title. So he knew that. So he comes and, you know, when he met him, instead of addressing him the way he is addressed normally,
He says to him, Anta Baqar. Baqar means a cow. And Baqir is very different. According to historians, Imam was lenient. He smiled at him and he says, maybe you have forgotten my laqab. La ana Baqir. I am not Baqar, I am Baqir. So this person continued insulting the Imam. And he says to him, Anta ibn al-tabbakha. Remember, we're talking about Eastern society, especially among the Arabs. To insult someone's mother is the crossing of the limit. But see how Imam deals with this situation. Then he says, you are the son of a woman who works in the kitchen, tabbakha, who is a cook. Again, Imam does not, you know, he realized now this person is really after me because he said Baqar and I said I am Baqir. Now he is talking about me as Ibn al-Tabbakha. Imam still looked at him and said, well, you know, at home, yes, she works in the kitchen. That's what she does as a wife and a mother. So what's wrong with that? Imam doesn't respond or argue with him on that issue.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
Some do not understand how exactly the Israeli regime's policy makes normal life impossible for Palestinians in Gaza, even when it's not bombing it. The siege amounts to a war crime. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is titled How Zionist Regime Slowly Suffocates Gaza. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Gaza is still reeling from the Zionist regime's 11-day bombing campaign in May. The Israeli regime assault started just before the Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of Ramadan, and ended with the killing of at least 245 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children. The bombs may have stopped dropping, but the devastation continues. Palestinians in the coastal enclave have been left to rebuild and recover from widespread destruction while living under a 14-year Israeli regime blockade that appears to hamper this process on certain political negotiations and outcomes. Since the assault, only food, medical supplies, fuel, animal fodder, and raw materials for critical industries have been allowed into the territory, the Times of Israel reported. Israeli regime occupation authorities have used their absolute control over maritime, airspace, and land entry and exit points to achieve political goals and objectives, according to the Gaza-based rights group Al-Mizan. Israeli regime politicians have suggested that they intend to reduce the amount of cash they allow into the strip. On July 14th, Israeli regime authorities allowed the entry of commercial goods, including clothes, for the first time since its assault, according to Safa News Agency. This came after COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of the Israeli regime's military occupation, the wards of the Gaza ghetto, announced a decision to ease imports and exports into the Gaza. COGAT boasted of extending the permitted fishing area from 9 to 12 nautical miles off of Gaza's coast, still way short of the 20 nautical miles stipulated by the Oslo Accords of 1990s. The post announcing the change on July 12th stated the decision was made following the recent security calm and after requiring political approval. The entry and exit of goods at the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing would also be eased, COGAT added. The group said the providing of such services, which benefit civilians, is conditional on maintaining security stability. The Israeli rights group's Gisha said COGAT's proposals are nowhere near enough to meet Gaza's needs or mitigate the harm caused by the blockade. While the Israeli regime permitted the entry of medical equipment, fishing, school supplies, shoes, and other items into Gaza, it is still barring thousands of materials, including construction equipment, raw materials, and spare parts, Gisha reported recently. It can seem a foreign concept to many to even contemplate a siege or blockade. Some do not understand how exactly the Zionist regime's policies makes normal life impossible for Palestinians in Gaza, and even when it's not bombing it. The siege amounts to a war crime, Al-Mizan has said, since it is collective punishment of 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza, about half of whom are children. Earlier this month, Gaza's electricity distribution company reported that less than 55% of electricity needs were met. Electricity is available for an average of just 13 hours per day across Gaza this year, according to UN Monitoring Group, OCHA. And this number assumes that all electricity lines from the occupied territories are active, which Al-Mizan noted is rare. Many crucial services underpinning daily life are affected by electricity shortages, from waste treatment through water services to the health sector. The Israeli regime has also been barring the import of almost all raw materials and equipment for reconstruction, with some minor exceptions like paper and detergents, Al-Mizan said. The Zionist regime's bombing of residential neighborhoods in Gaza has completely destroyed the homes of 8,500 people, the group said. 1 in 8 Palestinians in Gaza are unable to repair damages caused by bombings to their homes due to the Zionist regime's refusal to allow reconstruction materials into the enclave. Gisha pointed to reports claiming that the Zionist regime is conditioning Gaza's reconstruction efforts on certain political negotiations with Hamas. Textiles, furniture, farming, and fishing are some of the major industries impacted by the ongoing shortages of material, according to Gisha. Even acquiring a mattress is now difficult, Almizan said, because sponge factories cannot operate. Gaza's economy, already battered before the Israeli regime's assault, has been further devastated by the Zionist regime's latest aggression. Prices have risen in Gaza's market as a result of severe restrictions, as have job losses. Gaza already had one of the world's highest unemployment rates. Around 50% even before the Zionist regime's latest offensive, this number is expected to rise. Gaza is facing unprecedented levels of poverty, says Almizan, and the vast majority of residents, about 68%, are food insecure. During the recent assault by the Zionist regime, this regime also targeted 24 medical facilities in Gaza, according to a report by Almizan. And starting the second day of the assault and for its duration, the Zionist regime's military authorities refused to let any patient leave Gaza through the Erez checkpoint to receive treatment outside of the Gaza Strip. Almizan says several people died as a result. The Erez checkpoint is only one of the two points of entry and exit from Gaza, and the only one between Gaza and the occupied territories and the occupied West Bank. The Zionist regime has largely kept it closed, barring some exceptions, since March 2020 under the guise of the COVID-19 pandemic. The other is Egypt's heavily secured Rafah crossing, which is Gaza's only passage to the outside world, not directly controlled by the Zionist regime, but which is only open when it is open to passengers, not goods or for commerce. Egypt aids the Israeli regime in denying to Palestinians their freedom of movement in and outside of Gaza. This is the status quo of the Zionist regime's siege on Gaza, a nearly unlivable reality that Palestinians in the Strip return to after every round of Israeli regime bombing. Sometimes restrictions on imports and exports are tightened or loosened. Sometimes the permitted nautical miles off the Gaza shore are extended or reduced. But so long as the Israeli regime siege on Gaza continues, any drip feed changes will alleviate Palestinian suffering only in the very short term. Without any meaningful change to the end the blockade, the violence of the status quo persists.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I saw Jaladi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Now, the stage has come now where we speak about how to deal with enemies, or how to deal with people who are not in favor of us, not liking us. And this is something, of course, very, very natural. Throughout the process of your life, you're always going to come across with certain people who might be different with you in their ideology, in their opinion, in their conduct, in their behavior. There might be a dispute, there might be certain issues that escalate to such a level where they become hostile towards you. Now, there are different kinds of that level of hostility that a person has towards somebody else, but it's never going to be something good or something positive. Don't put yourself in such a situation where you are going to gain enemies. قال لقمان لابنه لقمان said to his son, from what he said to his son, لا تتخذ عدوا واحدا, don't even have one enemy. والواحد كثير, and even having one enemy is too much. And so we need to have that kind of attitude where, you know, we minimize our interaction with someone who we know will turn out to be a headache for us, if we could say. Do the means justify the end? Do we have this kind of sense where, well, seeing that it's an enemy, it doesn't matter what I do to him or her, you know, they're an enemy, you know, they're not Muslim, they're not religious, they're doing wrong to me, so therefore I'm going to do wrong back to them. Should you steep low to their level and react to them the same way that they are dealing with you? That's absolutely not. And that's why in any case we need to always remember to have that level of adl, to be just and fair, and also to make sure that we are munsif in our treatment of those who are against us as far as enmity is concerned. That's why the Quran says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَلَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَلَّا تَعْدُلُوا اعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَىٰ, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that there might be a group of people who, you know, push you towards not being just, not having adala. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, اعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ, and it is always going to be closer to taqwa. Imam Ali alayhi salam saying to his son, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, his advice he gives to him, أُوصِيكَ بِتَقْوَى اللَّهِ فِي الْغِنَى وَالْفَقْرِ, I remind you of being wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the case of richness and in the case of poverty. And then he says, وَبِالْعَدْلِ عَلَى الصَّدِيقِ وَالْ Adu, and for you to be fair, for you to be just towards your friend or your foe, towards your friend or your enemy. Imam Ali also said to his other son, Muhammad al-Hanafiyya, وَبْذُلْ لِصَدِيقِكَ نَفْسَكَ وَمَالَكَ, and give to your friend yourself and your wealth, sacrifice everything to your friend. وَلِلْعَامَّةِ بِشْرَكَ وَمَحَبَّتَكَ, and for everyone else, your smile and your compassion. وَلِعَدُوِكَ عَدْلَكَ وَإِنصَافَكَ, and you should give to your enemy your justice and your fairness. That's the kind of attitude that we need to always have when it comes to sharing what it is that Islam says to us, to those who are at enmity with us.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است، چه فلان دماغ و ثواب داره فلان رو دوم
است. One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فلان درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره، دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره، همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون، اینم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
From Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, that says that even when it comes to the time of testifying, that you should never testify something false against your enemy. وَلَا يَكْتُمُ شَهَادَتَهُ لِلْأَعْدَاءِ. And even if there is an enemy, that you shouldn't be concealing your testimony for your enemy. In the case of the enemy, whatever it is, you should never transgress their rights. Even if they are your enemy, they still have حقوق and rights, which is exactly why from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, we can understand that there needs to be that level of tolerance, there needs to be that level of overlooking as well, even if it is your personal enemy. Akrim man waddaka, be graceful to those who loves you. Wasfah an aduwika, and overlook your enemy, or be tolerant, or bear the difficulties of your enemy. Yatimu laka al-fadl, and you will become among those who have perfect virtue. And so in all we can understand that this is the kind of approach that we need to have towards those who are our personal enemies. And of course that's not something easy. It really does need a lot of tahdhibun nafs and a lot of patience as well, which is exactly what we can see consistent throughout the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.